From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. What do autographs reveal about Los Angeles?
This is a project that's been about whose names matter, whose marks on the city are preserved, whose marks on the city are covered up, whose signatures are coveted, and whose signatures are forgotten.
Josh Kuhn reworks LA Public Library's large collection of autographs. But first, almost 10 years ago, a young entrepreneur named Adam Neumann founded WeWork. It fast became one of the biggest landlords of co-working space. So big that he could boast that he was in the business of changing world consciousness and cities. He hired famed Danish architect Bjarke Ingels and a designer named Drawben Schetrit to lead his Future Cities initiative. Here's Neumann last year talking at the US Conference of Mayors.
As mayors, as leaders, as CEOs, it is our responsibility to set the trend of the future. And the trend is we versus me. And when by 2030, 60% of the world population is going to move into major cities, that's another billion people moving into major cities. Most cities are underbuilt 30 to 50%. This is in the next 12 years. You have no room. You have to reinvent how people live. You have to rezone. You have to reassess. And you have to reinvent how people work.
Well, the WeWork bubble has now burst. Like Icarus flying too close to the sun, Neumann got undone by hubris and he was removed from the helm of his company. Now the proposed WeWork IPO has been indefinitely postponed. Investors couldn't understand the business model nor why he was able to pay himself almost $6 million for use of the word we. So, where does that leave WeWork and co-working space? In a moment, we're going to hear from the founder of a Hollywood space that also wants to raise consciousness, but in a very different way. First up, though, we reached out to Marissa Gluck. She works in digital strategy and marketing, and she says that WeWork positioned itself as a tech company. However,
essentially, what WeWork was doing is engaging in real estate arbitrage. So they are taking long-term leases on property and then subdividing it and leasing it in shorter-term leases to renters. In an economic downturn or a recession, the first thing to go would be some of these short-term leases. For the single entrepreneur, the person who is able to work from home or have a home office or go to a coffee shop, it's much easier to spend $5 for free Wi-Fi at a coffee shop than $400 or $500 a month at a WeWork.
WeWork copycats, as well as actual branches of WeWork, have been exploding in Los Angeles. You've visited many of them. What does the WeWork IPO implosion kind of mean for the phenomenon in general, if it means anything?
I think it'll take a time to see what it means for that category overall. Hopefully some of the, I wouldn't necessarily call them copycats, but hopefully some of the other companies out there that are emulating that model are learning from the WeWork mistakes. They're not taking out these long-term leases, or they own some of their properties rather than leasing from other property owners and looking towards longer-term leases, higher revenue, other forms of revenue than just the leases. I know WeWork has sought to diversify their revenue streams. I think some of the other guys out there would probably do the same.
Now, what was also interesting about WeWork, at least to a design enthusiast audience, is that they had taken on the mantle of city building. How did you react to that? And were you following that path of WeWork?
I think anytime private entrepreneurs say they're going to remake civic institutions, it's cause for concern. We've seen these kinds of overblown claims from companies like Uber and Lyft who claim that they are going to revolutionize transportation. We've seen this from WeWork, who wants to rebuild cities. WeWork feels a lot like a lot of other Silicon Valley companies in the sense that they are true believers in their cause, but the rest of the public should be extremely skeptical of their claims. They're driven by dynamic personalities, charismatic leaders who people drink the Kool-Aid around, particularly investors. And it creates this hype cycle between media, money, and entrepreneurs that tends to be a virtuous circle or a vicious cycle, depending on how you look at it. They continue to reinforce the other till someone out there says, hold on, wait a minute, none of this makes sense. Let's actually take a look at the numbers. Let's actually look at what someone's building. Let's actually look at the cultures that they're creating and take a more skeptical eye towards what it is they're actually trying to do.
That's Moissa Gluck. She consults on digital strategy and marketing. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Since 2008, co-working space in Los Angeles has grown by 500%. It occupies over 3 million square feet, and it comes in packages to suit numerous niche markets. Most don't claim to be rebuilding cities, but they certainly aspire to enhance city life, and they do that in part with their design choices. Recent additions include The Wing in West Hollywood. That's the branch of a New York company that is aimed at a particular demographic and signals it with color and furniture choices. Audrey Gelman is co-founder.
Definitely a brand that is run by women, created for women, with women in mind. And so you see that throughout the space, from the temperature of the space, which is always 72 degrees, not cold like many corporate offices are, to the height of chairs. We actually make sure to design around the mean height of women, which is 5'4", to all sorts of other amenities like our lactation room, showers, and so on.
Then there's the newly opened second home in East Hollywood. This is all design flair, a retrofit of a Paul Williams design building and a parking lot recast by Spanish architect Sal Gascano as a lush garden with meandering paths and yellow-topped plastic yurts that serve as office spaces. And Second Home mixes the fee-paying membership model with public space and free events. Here's co-founder Rohan Silva.
There's this irony, which is people are quitting their corporate jobs and are starting their own thing, starting their own business, working for themselves, which is a lovely thing. Yet ironically, they're leaving the corporate cubicle behind and finding themselves in yet another corporate cubicle. And we think people deserve more than that. We think it's possible to design environments and cultural programs and curate communities such that it really supports entrepreneurship and creativity and helps people do better in this new economy. And architecture is right at the heart of that.
That was Rohan Silva with Second Home. We spoke with him and with Audrey Gelman on past DNA episodes. Now, The Wing got investment from WeWork, but being not like WeWork is something you hear from several co-working companies. Take Epiphany Space, for example. This artist community and co-working space in Hollywood has around 40 members. It's in a converted house that retains a homey feel. It, too, is trying to raise consciousness, albeit to a higher power. Dotted around the shelves, you can find Bibles and a prayer room that features a cross made of wood that was reclaimed from the Oklahoma tornado. Melissa Gibson-Smith is the founder and executive director. The name of the space refers to a creative breakthrough and...
It also means divine breakthrough. And there is a spiritual component to what we do that's available to the community, but our community opts in. We have folk from a lot of different spiritual backgrounds that are a part of Epiphany Space, but I myself am a minister, and I do a lot of inner healing and like heart care with folk and encouragement. And for me personally, yes, it has the double meaning.
So how do people find their way to you who might be looking for a community with a kind of a spiritual aspect to it?
People come for different reasons. And initially, it was just folk that were relationally connected to us or other people. And over time, as the co-working movement has taken off, folk find us online. We're a little bit more affordable than some of the other spaces that are available in the area. And we have a different vibe to us. We're not super shiny. We're cozy and comfortable. We have a lot of furniture and things that are upcycled. We have art that our local community has created that's on the wall. So we have folks that call us a home. They feel like they belong here. They can relax and be comfortable and collaborate with one another.
And when you say upcycled, but that's a nice way of saying used furniture. Is that right? You're not going for the expensive sort of hyper-designed interior.
No, not at all. And our path to being a co-working space has been very different than, you know, WeWork, for example. We started the same year as WeWork, but we started as a nonprofit. And our desire is to see artists thrive and create an environment for collaboration and creativity and community and breakthrough to happen. It's very kind of hands-on, collaborative, inviting of folks to share and support and encourage one another. And that kind of relaxed connectivity is also reflected in our design.
You said your organization is nonprofit. Do you see the kind of the WeWork model as sort of quite different in its kind of commercial aims?
Yeah, absolutely. Our primary focus is community. We're community first. And one of the expressions of the community is the co-working. And we have a lot of other things that happen on evenings and weekends that cultivate that that community and that collaboration.
So what kinds of community events might you have that have nothing to do with working?
Every week we have what we call Wine Wednesday, and it's a time of playing, and there's it's kind of like a happy hour of sorts, but we'll get together and play board games, we'll play Quiplash, we'll share music, we have a once a month supper song, which is an event that one of our staff puts on. And it's just a beautiful way of being vulnerable and open and transparent with one another.
I read that the Christian values embodied in Epiphany sometimes extend to giving people a break if they can't afford the monthly rent, which I think is around $200, is it? Perhaps compared to $400 that you might pay at another space. So tell us about an instance of that.
We had a gal that was in between jobs, and she thought she was going to get back on her feet pretty quickly, and came and joined us. And after working with us for several months, her finances were dwindling. She wasn't receiving the jobs as quickly as she thought that she would. And there was just a point one day where, you know, she just shared with me, look, at the end of the month, I'm going to be out of money, without a job, and alone without community because I can't come here. And I just looked at her and I told her, I was like, come anyway. And when you get back on your feet, you can pay it forward. And what we did is we offered her an opportunity to be able to host the space on a day. And, you know, she came in and made sure, we don't have a receptionist. She came in and made sure that everybody, you know, got what they needed and the space was open and the coffee was made. And that is our model with our community right now, is we have five different hosts that host a day a week, and they're community members. But I think that impacts the culture of the space.
There was a time before I think you even moved here where people did co-work, but in a much looser way, as in they'd hang out at Starbucks for several hours or in the local, you know, bookstore that happened to have a coffee bar. Why do you think that changed?
I think, at least for our space, the reason why folk are coming here versus a coffee shop is intentional relationship cultivation. You can go to, you know, your local coffee shop and be around people, but you're not necessarily getting to know them. And then in some coffee shop environments, it can be crowded and noisy. And you feel this pressure of, oh, I've got to buy another cup of coffee, or I need to, you know, make a phone call or go to the bathroom, and you have to pick up everything that you have with you in order to be able to, you know, do that task. And then you have to relocate. And a co-working space eliminates that. So I think LA can be a very lonely and disconnected place. And co-working spaces provide a place of genuine belonging. And that is a core need that we all, as humans all have, is to belong and to matter.
That was Melissa Gibson-Smith talking about Epiphany Space in Hollywood. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, a century-old project to collect signatures from people who count is reborn.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Over a century ago, Charles Lummis was the chief librarian of the Los Angeles Public Library. He sent pages of library stationery to dozens of celebrities of his day, a list he called People Who Count, and he asked them to send back their autographs. Many obliged, and thus was born an autograph collection. Enter Josh Kuhn. He is a MacArthur Fellow and Director of the USC Annenberg School of Communication, and he has just published The Autograph Book of LA, Improvements on the Page of the City. It was inspired by the library's autograph collection, and it is the third in a trilogy of books that he has edited and produced.
It's an accidental trilogy, I'd say. The first two books were like this one, based on the special collections of the Central Library of Los Angeles Public Library. And the first one was based on the sheet music collection that they have. And we were focusing on songs about Los Angeles and Southern California. And the second project was on their restaurant menu collection, focusing on the history of restaurants as told through menus. And that was called To Live and Dine in LA. What I learned in the process of doing these books is that while the actual collections themselves were driving the interest, it really became more a process about larger questions of how the history of Los Angeles is told. Most of us who work with archives have these moments every time of an archive is both a document of what's present, but also a document of what's not there.
As in missing histories
missing
of people.
Missing histories, yes.
And actually you refer in your setup to this book, to Roy Choi's reaction to your menus.
Yes. When we first started the menu project, the first thing I did is I wanted to bring a chef in with me because I'm not an expert in food history and food culture. And I asked Roy if he would come in, and the librarians brought out the kind of crown jewels of the 19th century menus, the earliest menus in the library's collection, the rarest artifacts. We were all so excited, and you know, in comes Roy. We're waiting to see the joy and awe on his face, which was there, but his first reaction was simply, well, where did everybody else eat?
Because these menus were the menus of fancy restaurants
frequented
by the city's establishment.
Yes, exactly. And by the financial elite and political elite of Los Angeles, banquet menus, very elegant menus. This is a project that's been about whose names matter, whose marks on the city are preserved, whose marks on the city are covered up, whose signatures are coveted, and whose signatures are forgotten.
And the book is called Autograph Book of LA, Improvements on the Page of the City. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the subtitle.
Sure.
What does that mean?
This actually comes directly from the solicitation letter by then city librarian Charles Lummis, who started the autograph collection at the public library in 1906. And when he sent out an invitation letter to quote unquote people who count, as he put it, famous people in various fields across the country, he sent them a piece of blank stationery that had letterhead on it that said autographs, Los Angeles Public Library, beautiful stationery. And he, instead of just asking for their signature, he asked them to improve upon this page. And I love that idea of improving upon a page, and that it wasn't just a signature. And in fact, he got back hundreds of quote-unquote autographs that were watercolors, that were excerpts of speeches, poems, drawings, and, you know, some simple signatures as well. But all of them were meant to be improvements on the page. And so I kind of ran with that idea with this book. And then in looking at an autograph collection from 1906, what does that matter for 2019?
Let's go back to Charles Lummis. You've just said we're talking 1906.
Yes.
He's the chief librarian. and he sends out a letter to people who whom he consider counts,
yeah.
and he asks for their autograph. This is very sort of pre-celebrity, or it seems to be anticipating our preoccupation with celebrity.
Yes, I always say he was, you know, he was pre-Kardashian, he was pre-Angeline. Lummis understood from the ground up that one could be famous for being famous. He understood the power of celebrity and fame in selling a concept. In this case, it was selling the concept of Los Angeles. And so I do think there was something very kind of ahead of his time, if you will, in understanding the role that celebrity would play in the way LA thinks about itself.
So some of the characters that he secured signatures from: John Quincy Adams, Mark Twain, Andrew Carnegie, Frederick Remington, John Muir, James Carroll Beckwith. These were all people he secured.
Correct.
Subsequently, more autographs are added. For example, we saw Langston Hughes. Did he get Langston Hughes?
No.
Or did that come later?
That came later. So, you know, the actual Lummis collection, for the most part, runs from about 1906 to 1910 or so. And then what's interesting is that librarians throughout the rest of the last century occasionally would continue the collection and bring in other autographs. And Langston Hughes is one of them. It was a handwritten version of a poem of his called Youth from 1935 that's in there. There also in the collection were two letters signed by Helen Keller to public librarians. So we include
those. Which is amazing given that Helen Keller was blind.
Absolutely.
So we as the reader get to see some of these historic autographs as well as photographs of the people, like you said.
Yes.
You, which actually begs the question, are you interested more in the signature or the person that gave the signature?
That's a great question. Well, sometimes the signatures are more interesting than people.
You know? And sometimes the other way around.
Oh boy, many times the other way around. So on the one hand, there's just pure design elements that you look and you say, what a gorgeous signature, or what an interesting way of leaving a mark. I mean, if we really break down the idea of an autograph to its root, this idea that the graph, which is scratching, that there's, you know, the idea that you would scratch the auto, you would scratch yourself.
Right. And is that the precursor of graffiti?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They're all related. This idea of scratching one's name in order to not be forgotten. And I think by extension, the signature stands in for the biography.
So take us to the present and what you then bring to this story in terms of the new stories that you're telling and the autographs that you saw.
Sure. So we started in talking about this project with current city librarian John Szabo. We always knew that this was not going to be a book about 1906, but about what this impulse that Lummis had means for contemporary LA. And so John and I had lots of conversations about how to activate that. And, you know, he really led the way in saying, well, we should have a new autograph day, where we have an autograph day that is open to the people who count in Los Angeles, which is everyone. And so we had an autograph day last June across the city of Los Angeles at multiple branch libraries, and invited anyone who wanted to come on in and improve upon the page of the city and of the stationery. We printed replicas of the original stationery with Aardvark Press, really important, longstanding folks here in LA, and beautiful. They did a beautiful job. And we had hundreds of people come in that day and leave autographs and stories and drawings. And so that's in the book. And then to add to that, I also decided I'm going to go look around and just kind of think about who else could be interesting to leave their autograph to join this chorus.
You did. You looked for your own set of people who count.
Yeah, it was less people who count. I was thinking about people whose voices and whose stories and whose work were making important interventions in contemporary LA, but also in the past, whose contributions to the city were both important and interesting, but also maybe overlooked.
So there's many people we could talk about, because many crop up in the book. One of them that I think is really at the intersection of the beautiful craft of writing as well as being part of the story of Los Angeles, interesting contribution to the story of LA, is Chaz Bojorquez, whose visual statements are so
incredible.
Beautiful. Yes. Tell us about him.
So Chaz is a legend for graffiti writers in L.A. He's considered one of the kind of godfathers, one of the real icons. But he's a trained painter, and his work moves across both graffiti, street art, graphic design, poster design, advertising. He's a fascinating figure, a really important figure. And you know, he's someone who's also deeply tied to the roots of graffiti writing and, let's say, public signatures and public signature writing in L.A. Within Mexican-American Los Angeles. And when I went and started talking with him, I'd been a longtime admirer of his work and really, to be frank, thought our conversation would be about graffiti and street art and the relationship between gang culture and graphic design. And it became, we talked as much about that as we talked about his love of the Grauman's Chinese handprints and footprints. We talked about the work he did.
Which is another form of signature.
Absolutely. And that's featured in the book as well. We talked about his stint working in Hollywood, actually designing film posters and doing graphic design work for motion pictures. And we talked about his relationship to Highland Park, a neighborhood he still lives in, and his own obsession with sidewalk writing of people leaving their names in wet concrete and walking around with his friends looking for how we can tell how neighborhoods change based on the names, what year certain names were left in the pavement. And it was a conversation that I think really influenced the kind of breadth of the things I wanted to look at in the book.
So give us a couple of other examples of the contemporary handwriters that or autograph writers that, that you loved.
Well, I have to say some of my favorite pieces really did come from Autograph Day. There's a pairing that I think is really important in the book where we had an LAPD officer come in and leave his badge number on the stationery and signed his name. And then he put in quotes, "Let me see your hands." And then we also had numerous people come in and write or draw images addressing police violence in Los Angeles and addressing injustices against particularly African Americans in Los Angeles by the LAPD. And that juxtaposition is really important, I think, in the book to understand that there are always these competing narratives that autographs and signatures can reveal and highlight.
One of the contributors to the book is Shepard Fairey,
yes,
the designer, artist, graphic designer. And he writes a very thoughtful essay. He says, letter writing used to be a real art form. It was how you presented your personality and the kind of person you are through your handwriting. Now it's C, as in letter C, U, letter U, later in a text message. The handwritten autograph may remain relevant, but it will be disconnected from that former culture of writing. Do you agree?
I try really hard not to fall into, you know, the easy, like, oh, it's all over. It's a matter of what's being taught, certainly. Of course, text culture has taken over all of us, and we all are now used to customizing our own voice using tools given to us by programs and algorithms and pre-existing operating systems. And that, sure, that's a worry in terms of the end of a particular era. And, you know, to get a handwritten letter in the mail now means it's a real statement if you receive that. But I do think that there is still this underlying draw that we all have where we, for the people that matter to us, be they famous people or just people who matter to us, good friends, family, having something in their hand matters. And we still line up for it and we covet it. And that desire to say, I was here, I mattered, I want the world to know I was here, that's not going anywhere.
That was Josh Kuhn. He's professor of communication at USC's Annenberg School. And he's the author of The Autograph Book of LA, Improvements on the Page of the City. There's an exhibition based on the project up now at LA Central Library. You've been listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Avishai Altsy produced and edited the show with a final mix by Ray Guana. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.